Hi, welcome to Head Start, the podcast for race directors and the business of putting on races. If you have been putting on races for a while, it probably won't surprise you to hear that organizing events is one of the most stressful jobs out there. How stressful? Well, according to a 2019 survey by job searching site CareerCast, it is in fact the sixth most stressful job you can do, less stressful only to careers like the military and firefighting. So, what makes putting on events so stressful? What toll is it taking on people like you working every day to make amazing races happen? And what can you do to manage your stress levels long term and avoid mental health decline? Today, we're going to be going over all that in a really candid discussion on stress and mental health in our industry with the help of my guest, Eventwell's Helen Moon. Helen has been working in the event industry in different capacities for decades, and as the founder and chief executive of nonprofit Eventwell, has most recently been focusing her energy on providing mental health support to event management professionals. I'm particularly delighted to have the opportunity to share this discussion with all of you today, as I know that talking about stress and mental health is particularly difficult to do for some people and remains a bit of a taboo subject, even among close friends and family. Last thing, before we get into this great discussion, I'd like to give a quick shout out to the amazing sponsors supporting this podcast. So many thanks to Run Signup, Race Director's favorite all-in-one technology solution for endurance and fundraising events, now powering more than 26,000 in-person, virtual, and hybrid events. And many thanks to RaceCheck, whose free RaceCheck review box widget can help you collect and showcase your participant feedback on your own website, helping you more easily convert website visitors into paying participants. And we'll be hearing a bit more from these two great companies a little later in the podcast. But now, let's dive into our discussion on managing stress with Eventwell's Helen Moon. Helen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you very much for taking the time. First of all, can you tell our listeners where you're based?
I am based in sunny Greenwich in London.
Awesome. I lived there for like 2 or 3 years when I first moved to London. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, I've been here 16 years, 17 years now. And I can't imagine, I'm not too sure if I want to retire in London, but I can't imagine moving right now. So yeah, it's a beautiful part of the world.
It is indeed. So it's a bit of a special episode and you're a bit of a special guest today because you're sort of a little bit outside the strict confines of the endurance events industry. Usually we get people who are, you know, like directly working on events, but you are a veteran of the events industry at large. You've done a lot of things even before we get to Eventwell, which is much more relevant to today's discussion. Do you mind telling our listeners a little bit about what you've done in events through the years?
Yeah, I will do, definitely. And does it count that I've actually ran 5 half marathons and the London Marathon? So
excellent.
While I'm not working in endurance events, I'm a partaker.
Perfect.
or was until I was up at nearly approaching 50 kind of stuff and kind of. Yes, yeah. No, I'm still a partaker. So, yes, I have worked in UK events industry for 25 years this year. So 1997 was my year of induction, shall we say, at the ripe old age of 24. Previous to that, I was a PA, which explains that transition from PA work into event management. I was an executive board level PA, quite a young age. To be kind of a senior level PA, and it fell into the industry completely by chance of having exec level, board level PA on my CV, applying for a role as to send my CV to a hotel in sunny Southport. I live in sunny Greenwich now. I'm actually from sunny Southport, which is what people officially call it, sunny Southport up in the northwest. And the hotel general manager basically turned around and said, I'm not looking for a PA, but I am looking for an event coordinator. You have event management on your CV. Would you give it a go? The rest, as they say, is history. So I've worked on a supplier side of event planning and event coordination, which is a very unique kind of area of event management to work in, because predominantly you are the event coordinator on behalf of a lot of customers and clients, who some who are professional event managers. So you coordinate, you're that liaison point. But actually, a lot of your customers and clients are people that have never organized an event before, particularly when it comes to personal events such as, you know, celebrations, weddings, that kind of side. They've never organized events before. So you kind of step in as that professional event coordinator and organizer for them. So I did that for about 7 years. Then I moved down to London in 2003 and moved into proactive sales, again in hotels and venues. So I spent 17 years in our industry in hotels and venues on the supplier side. Operations is my true love, though. I was quite good at sales. I managed to bring in some business, and people kept employing me over a 10-year business. So I must have been pretty good at it. But my true love is operations. That's where I get the buzz. I'm happiest in the throes of an operation, but I also need that quiet element as well. So, which we'll chat about through this session in terms of explaining that a little bit. And then in 2015, I moved on to into freelance work. And then in 2017, freelance event management work. So I am actually a qualified event manager, event director, marketing communications manager as well. And in 2017, I launched Eventwell. And Eventwell was supposed to be an annual campaign for the events industry. And it doesn't matter who you are in the events industry, it's supposed to be a campaign. It's Event Wellbeing Week next week. It's supposed to start on Monday. We will be delaying the start on Monday for obvious reasons, because there's a little state funeral happening on Monday, so we'll be delaying the start until the 20th of September. And that has been happening since 2017. So the brand Eventwell started as Event Wellbeing Week in 2020, we introduced Event Wellbeing Day, closely followed by about a week after launching Event Wellbeing Day, closely followed by the COVID-19 pandemic and the shutdown of the industry effectively. But after our first Event Wellbeing Week, we identified that, I have a history in terms of mental health as well, which is my personal story and motivation for launching and starting Eventwell. In 2017, we kind of identified that I kind of know, and people that we work with and who helped to co-launch Event Wellbeing Week were aware that there was an issue in terms of mental wellbeing in our industry. It's not rocket science. Anybody who works in our industry is aware that there is an issue in terms of stress and mental wellbeing. We identified that the issue was a little bit more than we thought it might be. And it's also coincided with that event coordination's their fifth most stressful career by career cast of the previous year. We identified that approximately 1 in 3 event professionals will struggle with their mental wellbeing every year, or mental health related illness every year, of which mental health related illness is stress and burnout. And we decided, and I decided to actually take the Eventwell brand and launch it as a social enterprise. So we are a charitable and community social enterprise. We're an official not-for-profit. So basically what that means is we have products and services that we are able to sell, which a charity, unfortunately, doesn't have the freedom and flexibility to be able to trade. And then what we do is the profits that we earn from the products and services that we sell, we give that money away in the form of grant giving. So, which is a charitable aspect of what we do. We give grocery shops, we give hardship relief grants. We pay for talking therapies for event professionals as an event professional we've been supporting for nearly 2 years now in terms of paying for their support and talking therapy. So there's a very important, very serious side in terms of what we do. But predominantly we're here to campaign, educate and support better mental wellbeing in our industry, much needed, as identified in 2017, which has only been exacerbated by the pandemic. But in a way, something that was probably going to happen anyway.
Eventwell, just so sometimes when I try to understand things, I try to put them in my own words. Basically, what you're saying is, which is something I see lots of cause-based nonprofits do a lot. So you provide event well-being services to the industry for a fee, and then you take those proceeds and you channel them into other well-being projects within the events industry, supporting event professionals through, you know, like therapy sessions, all kinds of educating, all that kind of stuff, right?
Yes, absolutely. So support for us falls under two kind of categories. So support for us falls under our commercial and trading products and services, which is our quiet rooms and safe spaces that we provide on site at events, which is our main service. That's predominantly what we do now as of about a year ago. So our quiet room, Eventwell Hub, it's called. So our hub service is now a year old. The profits from that service get invested into the campaign and support, charitable support kind of element of what we do, which is the grant giving kind of side. So basically those profits from event organisers buying products and services from us, the profits from that goes back into the pockets of event organisers and event professionals. So we have a nice 360 degree kind of money coming in, money going out, kind of stuff, money coming in, going out. And we ensure that that money goes to people who need it. And that the whole purpose of giving people that support is to help to prevent mental decline. Because for us, poor mental health is not necessarily about chemical imbalances, as we've been led to believe for many years, mainly because that's education that comes out from our perspective, from the pharmaceutical companies that wants GPs to keep on buying the drugs that deal with chemical imbalances. And whilst there's a place for medication, and this could be a whole other session, whilst there's a place for medication, of course, it can help people in the short term. It's not a long term. It's not really a long term solution. We believe more that mental decline is due to environment and circumstance where we live. There are five elements to well-being, which are career, social, financial, physical, and environmental or community well-being. And all of those five areas can have an impact on how we are feeling at any one time. So it's about, you know, career well-being. Is it fundamentally, that's about, do I enjoy what I do every day? Social well-being is, my relationships as strong as they possibly could be. Financial well-being is, do I have enough money to do the things I want to do? Physical well-being is, do I have enough energy to be able to do the things I want to do? And then community environmental well-being is, do I enjoy where I live? Do I like where I live? So if you were to ask somebody, how's your life? What do you think about your life? Fundamentally, those are the five areas that we default to when we answer those questions kind of stuff. So for us, mental well-being is about those five different areas, those five elements of well-being. Chemical imbalance has a role to play somewhere. You know, some people are more susceptible to poor mental health than others. And that comes down to genetics and DNA. So, you know, that biological kind of aspect of it does have a part to play. But more often than not, mental decline is triggered by the five elements that I've just talked about.
Let's take a look at those, because you mentioned earlier that there was a survey done, and it's been done for a few years by a kind of careers website called CareerCast, looking at some of the most stressful jobs out there. And last one I came across, 2019, event coordinator was on number 6. And it's all the more noteworthy to see what the five jobs before that were, just so people understand where number 6 comes in. So number 1, it's military personnel. So basically, you know, being in a war zone. Number 2 is a firefighter, self-explanatory. Number 3 is airline pilot. 4 is police. 5 is broadcaster, similar kind of pressures, I guess, with the event coordinator there. And then you have event coordinator. So along the dimensions that you mentioned are, you know, like physical factors, economic factors, all of that stuff. Why is it that planning events is such a stressful job to do?
Yeah, and it'd be quite interesting, because actually in 2016, broadcaster wasn't there. So it'd be quite interesting to go, what's going on in broadcasting? My husband actually works in broadcaster media. So, and then kind of watching him, I kind of understand probably why broadcaster and stuff has actually snuck up in there. Because there's lots of stuff happening in that industry from an environment. You know, what I was just talking about, the five elements of well-being. There's lots of things happening in that industry. Would it explain that pressure and why that's increased? Why is it there? Anybody who's worked in events for any period of time, whether somebody has interned right through to veterans, as we call, which are the people like us who have worked in events for a slightly longer period, knows that they are stressful and pressured. So event management falls under project management. And project management is hard work. Kind of stuff. It's hard. It's deadline orientated. And there's a lot of pressure. You're dealing with a huge amount of stakeholders. I mean, you're not just dealing with one or two people. You're literally dealing with, for any type of events, you're dealing with anything from roughly about 50 people can be involved in an event, right up to thousands. So you imagine the kind of pressure from that. And there's what we call the kind of, I don't know if you've heard in project management, it's forming, storming, performing. So that is a natural kind of life cycle of a project management. And basically what that talks about is you've got the forming element. So that's at the start of the event when the plans and the strategic kind of elements of putting an event together are being put in place. So you bring in people together and these are all new people. It could be that you've got established relationships and you work with the same suppliers and the same people all the time. But, you know, sometimes you can still have that kind of forming element at the start because the event might be slightly different. And then after that forming, what you tend to find is it goes into what we call the storming period. And that's where you get the battle of wits. You get people, you start to learn about different people's personalities. We're all different. We're not robots. We're not machines kind of stuff. We're human beings with individual values and beliefs and ideas and things that we want to achieve. And sometimes we can come into conflict with people. And then you get into the performing aspect, which I always say is the actual delivery of the event itself. So that's when everything seems to gel and come together, despite how stormy that planning stage might have been. But everything comes together for that performing because you have a project to deliver, which is the event. Whether that's a conference, whether it's an endurance event, whether it's a training session, whatever that might be, there's still that delivery aspect. Now, what you've also got to do is you've also got to fit that in with what we call the three stages of stress, which are alarm. So that's when the stress response has been triggered. Now, the stress response is controlled by what's called the autonomic nervous system, so the ANS. And the ANS predominantly has two main kind of parts to it. So we talk a lot about the stress response, which you'll have heard about, which is fight, flight, freeze. You'll have all heard the analogy, the fight, flight, freeze. Something triggers you. You'll have all heard the story about the dinosaur chasing the caveman. Stress, fight, flight, freeze. Does the caveman run away? Does it fight or does it to freeze and hide? What people don't necessarily understand is everything. There's a yin and yang and balance to everything in life. Okay. The yang to the stress response is yin, is what we call the parasympathetic nervous system. So what normally happens is stress response gets triggered. There's a threat. There's a challenge. We feel endangered. We fight, we flight, we freeze. What normally happens after that in pre-modern world is that our body would then, or the ANS would then trigger the parasympathetic nervous system once the threat or challenge has gone away. And the parasympathetic nervous brings us back to what we call rest and digest. So that's where our heart rate starts to be lowered. So the sympathetic nervous system increases your heart rate. The reason it does that is to pump more blood around the body to get more oxygen to the muscles for us to be able to fight or freeze. Okay. It also slows down not what it deems to be at that moment in time, non-essential life-saving functions, which is your digestive system. So that's why if you don't like public speaking and you get a dry mouth, that's because your body's triggered the stress response. So saliva in the mouth is part of the digestive system. So food starts to break down in the mouth before it even goes down your esophagus into your stomach. We have to think about things like that. The parasympathetic nervous system starts to bring back all of those functions, slows down the heart rate. It starts to bring the body back to its balance, its equilibrium, or the official name is homeostasis function, okay, where everything's performing normally. rest and digest. So you can't have one without the other. So if the sympathetic nervous system has been triggered, the parasympathetic nervous system that needs to be working in synergy with that to help you manage your stress levels. And you'll tend to find that if you have nice, lovely balance between your sympathetic nervous system and your parasympathetic nervous system, so you've got a nicely balanced operating ANS, autonomic nervous system, you're less likely to suffer from burnout. That's the alarm stage. And the parasympathetic nervous system just should really kind of kick off on what we call the resistance stage after the alarm stage. And this is when the body should be returning to rest and digest. But what happens is it will, for a period of time, stay on high alert in case a challenge comes back. In prehistoric time, it used to be, in case a dinosaur comes back, you're still on alert a little bit. In modern life, particularly in event management, the challenge is still there, okay? The pressure is still there. The stress is still there. It doesn't disappear. And depending on how long you organise an event for will determine pretty much how long you're in that resistance stage and how long you stay in that resistance stage. So this is the issue with burnout and event management. The resistance stage is longer. The stress and the pressure is still there. So it's much harder for our bodies, that ANS, so autonomic nervous system, to be able to kick off the parasympathetic nervous system naturally. So we need to learn as events people to put ourselves in the best possible environment we can to help our bodies do that. But we don't. 9 times out of 10, we choose not to. And then basically what happens, a third stage of stress is what we call exhaustion. That is burnout. So you've got your three stages of alarm, resistance, burnout. Okay. Now you tie that up with the project management of forming, storming, performing. So alarm for forming, resistance for storming. Okay. Can you see how the two are going together? And then you've got performing, but it can very, very easily turn into, fall into exhaustion from the stages of stress. If we haven't done certain things in those, in that resistance stage and that storming stage. So we need to be really, really looking after ourselves and taking care of ourselves in the resistance stage. So it's really important that we start from a stress management perspective, that we understand that, that we start to understand and appreciate the biology a little bit, because there's a lot of what we do as professionals that the biology is going to work against us a little bit. And that is why we have such high levels of stress. It isn't necessarily the fact that, you know, the onus can't just be put on employers and our bosses in terms of, well, you're not taking care of me. The onus is on us as well as individuals to make sure that we're doing all we can from a self-care perspective to be giving our biological systems the best chance.
So basically what you're saying is that what's sort of particularly stressful about event planning is the fact that, you know, from the day when you decide to put on the event up until, you know, the last guest has left and probably a little while after that, you're constantly at pressure, feeling the challenges of the event. And basically you're saying that part of the answer to that, which we'll talk more about later on, is finding ways throughout that period to basically bring down your levels of sympathetic system excitement, I guess, and just go back and rest that, give that a rest a little bit, which for many people listening in, I'm sure will sound much easier said than done, which I guess is part of the problem. In terms of mental health within the industry, the epidemiology of it, you mentioned that it's a quite common thing and you would know best because, you know, you research this and you speak to people all the time. In terms of how openly people in the events industry discuss these kinds of things these days, I'm sure there's going to be cultural differences between even UK and US, let alone Western countries and the rest of the world. How far have we come in terms of people being open and feeling comfortable discussing these things when they come up?
It's starting to become the norm, isn't it? So it is starting to become what we call normalized, which is amazing to see. We've still got a long way to go. I would say it's much more normal in our personal lives for us to talk about it now. We've got massive steps we still need to take in terms of our professional lives. So whilst we're comfortable in a social setting, talking to friends and family about something that we might be experiencing, we're not so comfortable talking to our colleagues about it yet. So, and it's, you know, the analogy that many people have heard, you'd have no hesitation telling somebody if you've broken your leg or if you've got a cold or flu or migraine. But if we're feeling any kind of elements of poor mental well-being, or feeling even the start of mental decline, then we shy away from the subject. And there's lots of reasons behind that as well. And there's lots of stigma associated with that, which we'll chat about. So we need to allow people time to get used to the idea. We are going to see increasing levels of poor mental well-being while that happens. So that will feed the normality, if that makes sense, in a way, because it's, in a way, it's becoming more common, but it's not necessarily the fact that more people are becoming mentally unwell. It's, you know, being fed as well by the fact that people are actually being their true selves and being completely honest, whereas it's something that they would have hidden before. So you'll hear lots of stories of people admitting that, yes, in 2002, I experienced a burnout breakdown, and only my wife, my husband, my partner, my girlfriend, my family, my friends kind of knew kind of stuff. Nobody at work had any idea, because we've all lived in that world, haven't we? And we put our hands on our hearts and admit that if it's not been ourselves, we all at least have one colleague that we're aware of that kind of went on the 2 week last minute vacation kind of stuff. So then it was like, and nobody really knew why. And you generally tend to find that that's somebody who's experienced a burnout, has been signed off by their doctor for stress, and be told that they need to rest because it's, you know, it could be something more serious than that. Worse than not, obviously, in the very serious side of why it's important to have these discussions and to educate, and for us to start moving the dialogue a little bit, is the life kind of saving element of mental health conversations. And it's, I'm a survivor myself. I'm a very open person, so I'm very comfortable talking this, but I'm a survivor myself of attempting to take my own life, so suicide. And there'll be people that are listening to this conversation that will have experience either of that themselves, but have never spoken about it openly, or they'll know somebody themselves personally, or they'll know somebody who knows somebody. So that's a very serious side. And that is a consequence of us not having these open conversations. We saw World Suicide Prevention Day on Saturday. So, you know, it's just really important that we keep on having these conversations and drive things forward for change.
This perception I have, and maybe others do, of maybe older generations viewing mental health in a slightly less helpful way, I guess, and stopping themselves from being more open about this. Is that something that you also observe sort of on the field, that, you know, perhaps people of a certain age feel more the pressure of the taboo of not speaking out about it?
Absolutely. But in consequence, let's not boom a bash, as I call it, kind of stuff. It's not necessarily their fault. We have to understand what the world was like previous to even the kind of 1960s, 1970s, even to the 1990s kind of stuff. I'm myself, as a 49-year-old woman, has already lived, and I'm still living, obviously, because it's a chronic condition. I'll have it for the rest of my life. Has lived with bipolar disorder since the age of 16, but it took 20 years for me to be diagnosed correctly. So I struggled for a very, very long time as a very young person, struggled. And also as well, at the age of 49, I've only just recently been diagnosed as neurodivergent as well. High functioning for all three. So high functioning in terms of bipolar. So what we mean by high functioning, even though it's a term that we're starting to use less of, but it's still been there as an educational aspect, as an educational tool more than anything else. What we mean by highly functioning is that I'm able to carry out a very normal life. So the majority of people wouldn't know. I don't need aid and assistance and support, an intervention or medical intervention in order for me to be able to live my life. I lead a very, very normal life. I have a career. I run my own business. I'm a mother. You would have no idea, unless you were particularly close to me, And then you would know. And that's because, you know, attitudes, even when I was a child, as a child of two boomers, 70s, even though they both worked for the NHS, so I have a little bit more awareness of it, and they both worked in mental health services as well. So I have a bit more awareness of it as a child as well. But that still didn't have an impact, because attitudes in the 70s, 80s and 90s and understanding even in the NHS was very different in the 70s, 80s and 90s. Now, previous to that, and even in the 70s when I was a child, we still had institutions, as you call them. So we still had mental health hospitals. So it's understandable why fear is still at the epicenter of stigma and discrimination. It's a fear of it, because previous to what we call care in the community kind of coming into play, kind of the 80s, 90s really is when that properly kind of came into play. If you were mentally ill, you'd be in a hospital. And previous to the kind of 60s, you'd be locked away in that hospital, institution they were called then, and you'd probably, prisons really, and you probably wouldn't be seen again. Or heard of. And that fear of judgment and what people would think would mean that your family would never talk about you. I mean, you only have to look at stories of mental institutions in the 1800s, early 1900s. I mean, if you had depression, you'd be locked away in an institution. You've seen images of women and men with no clothes, chained to the floor, lying on straw, and not even on the bed. I mean, it's abhorrent in terms of how, because of fear, how people who lived with just poor mental health, I mean, women would be locked away in mental institutions just for having PMT. It's where the word hysteria comes from, by the way. So it's locked in that mental health stigma. So there's a lot of back history and trauma and generational trauma that feeds into that. So like other areas of discrimination, we need to understand that a little bit in terms of why people would be fearful, why even a generation as near as the boomers, because that's only when we started to see the first elements of change. But it's only now in the years that we're starting to see massive change in terms of that. So we always say approach everything with empathy, with kindness. It's understandable. If you do your research into the history of the treatment of people living with mental health conditions and your diversity as well, you'd understand why, if you were a family member or you were yourself and you became unwell, you'd understand why some people would be like, what's going to happen to me? How am I going to be treated? Am I going to lose my job? Am I going to lose my promotion? What's my partner going to do? It's understandable where that fear comes from.
Yeah. And that fear, of course, which is the big sort of like catch 22 of this whole mental health thing, is that it feeds itself, right? I mean, it's a spiral, right?
Fear feeds fear.
And then it all gets out of control.
Yeah. And then fear feeds the mental decline as well. And actually, because they call it the spiral. So once you get caught in the spiral. And again, and this is why, again, kind of mental health conversations and driving this forward, it is really important. It's really important. And it's only by doing that, by sharing information, by being very open and honest about, you know, the past treatment of people and that generational trauma as a result of that, that we can actually really drive impact and change.
It's still a challenging market out there, and whatever hopes we all had of a full recovery to 2019 numbers seem to have been a little bit premature, unfortunately. And it's been a very hard time for all you guys out there putting on races, whether it's through a non-profit, a for-profit, or a local running club. But hopefully you're not giving up, and this may even be the time to be bold, to be looking to improve and grow the races you already put on. For those of you looking to do that, there's one platform that can really up your game across almost every aspect of your event, from the way you take registrations to how you market your race, and even how you manage your event on race day. And that platform is RunSignUp. You know, I keep banging on about Run Sign Up because beyond the great people I frequently get to speak to over there, I hear great things about Run Sign Up all the time from the hundreds of Run Sign Up customers that are part of our Race Directors HQ community. And frankly, that's all stuff you just can't fake. So take a minute, just a minute, and go visit runsignup.com. That's runsignup.com. Have a look around at the features they have to offer. And if you have any questions or want to see some of those tools in action, just click to book a free demo. It's right there at the top of the page. Give it a try. 26,000 races can't be wrong, you know. Okay, now let's get back to the episode. You mentioned earlier, you took us through a brief description of how the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems work in balance in helping you manage stressful situations, but then sort of like climbing down from that and how events make that a little bit harder for people. And you mentioned mental health decline, which is, I guess it can have degrees and it sounds a bit vague or basically all encompassing to me. In terms of like just going back to events, how quickly does that mental decline sort of come on? Are we talking that, you know, like you've been under stress putting on events for years on end, and then, you know, like on year 20 to 30, gradually this happens? Or are we talking one day you just step out, get into the car and you can't turn on the engine kind of thing? Like how quickly do these things, does this deterioration come on?
Oh, there's lots of influences to this. So first of all is kind of understanding stress and pressure and what that is. We use an analogy in the mental health world called the stress bucket. So I'll come into that second. So first is understanding stress and what that is. So in our world, in anybody's world really, there are two types of stress. There's positive stress, eustress is the official name for it, and then there's negative stress, distress. The two feel very different, which you're coming to. So positive stress, event management is one of those things. Work and event, our work, our careers is positive stress. Okay. We need to go to work every day. We need purpose. We need direction. We need something to get out of bed for. Nobody not wants to work. The majority of people don't not want to work. We need to go to work to earn money to be able to do the things that we want to do. So it's very, very important to us. And also remembering as well that one of the first questions we ask somebody else when we meet them is, what do you do? So it just kind of signifies how important our jobs and roles are to us. So work is supposed to be a positive stress. Other examples of eustress and positive stress are getting married, moving house, doing exams, exercise, is endurance events. Nobody really wants to run a marathon.
Well, your body doesn't, I can tell you that.
Well, yeah, your mind might want to because it's the adrenaline kind of aspect of doing it, because your body, some people get addicted to running marathons and endurance events, don't they? It's because of they get addicted to the adrenal effect in the body, because your body, when you're running a marathon, is continuously releasing the stress response to get you to keep your heart beating fast, to keep the oxygen flowing to you. That's why it's not, they say in terms of training for a marathon, don't run a marathon before running a marathon, because you're going to burn your body out, basically. It hasn't got the strength for you to be able to do that unless you're your body's used to running marathon after marathon after marathon. If you're a novice, don't try to run two marathons in one go. You don't want to end up with a trip to A&E or anything worse, unfortunately. But that kind of explains that. So exercise, endurance events, good positive stress. We need positive stress. It's really good for our mental well-being. Our brain wants that positive stress. It keeps us motivated. It inspires us. It keeps us productive. It keeps us creative. It keeps us coming up with new ideas. And that's what the brain wants to be doing. It feels good. Okay. It feels exciting. We still get nerves. So you can still get nervous. And that's the adrenal response. Okay. So that's the adrenaline being triggered in the body. It's basically because your gut has a massive kind of link to mental well-being as well. Your adrenaline gland is situated just above your kidneys, so it's around that gut area. 60% of the serotonin that's produced in the body is produced in your gut, not your brain. So there's massive. That's why you get the nerves, basically from the biological kind of aspect. So nerves are good. It's a good sign. It's a good sign of eustress. Negative stress, on the other hand, feels very different. It feels uncomfortable. It doesn't feel nice. You don't feel motivated. You feel quite scared. So you feel scared rather than nervous. And we all know the difference between nervous, you're a bit twitchy and stuff, scared, you're already flight. You're already running, wanting to run away. It's learning from a self-awareness perspective what those two feel like for you. Apart from the obvious, which we all know, that the Sunday evening dread. So if you are starting to get the Sunday evening dread, do something about it. Why? Why are you getting the Sunday evening dread? Is there anything I can change to make that feel more comfortable, to move that uncomfortable kind of feeling away from it? Because that is a sign of mental decline, the Sunday evening dread. Yeah, not wanting to get up in the morning is a sign of mental decline. Your behavioural change, being snappy with people, getting headaches, being short-tempered, feeling tired, waking up in the morning, not feeling rested, are all signs of mental decline. So it's learning, and we're all individuals as well, so it can feel very different for different people. So it's learning self-awareness in terms of self-management and self-care and stress management is fundamentally the key to this. It's understanding the difference between the two. And then, you know, mental decline, if you can catch it early, and this is all about being proactive rather than reactive. So if you can catch it early, if the things that are worrying you and troubling you, you'll tend to find that you'll start to worry about things more. You'll be cautious, more cautious about things, I think is what I'm trying to say. That awareness and caution will be there much more. Talk to people about it. And try as much as you can. That for me, when I start to feel like that for me is a sure sign that I need to take a step back and rest and give my body a chance for the parasympathetic, for that balance to start to come in. And let's have a little bit more parasympathetic nervous system, and let's try and keep control of the sympathetic nervous system a little bit, just for everything to come back to an equilibrium.
Just so I try and tie this back to actual clinical psychiatry, when you are at that early stage of mental decline, is that a clinical condition? You know, you go to the doctor and you say, you know what, I'm having trouble getting out of bed, and you know, like I have so many things to do, it's so stressful, I can't give them up, but I need to do them. Like, when you're at that stage, is that something that sort of medical science would recognize as a mental, already as like a mental health condition? Or do you need to go further than that, deeper than that, to actually go into something that would be clinically recognized as mental health issues?
Yeah. So in terms of clinical psychiatry, they can only diagnose what would be termed as a clinical condition. So clinical condition, depression is a clinical condition, and probably one of the only ones that doesn't need to be. You don't need a clinical psychiatrist to diagnose that. So pretty much by having a conversation with your GP. And there has to be a period of time as well, because what we have to understand is it's normal for people to have highs and lows. It's normal for you to have a period of not having energy and not wanting to do things. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're clinically depressed. It's when you're having those feelings, but over a long period of time. So a GP will normally ask you, have you felt like this for a period of longer than 2 weeks? And then it's looking at the ways that you can treat. So just because you're experiencing what we term as mental decline doesn't mean that you have a clinical mental illness. And then there's other aspects of obviously clinical psychiatry, which is what we would call where mental disorders kind of come into play, which is people like myself, I have bipolar, which is also a depressive disorder, but it's also a psychotic disorder. And then there's the anxiety disorders. So there's the depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, OCD, generalized anxiety disorder, panic attacks, all that all fall under anxiety disorders. And then there's the psychotic disorders, which are schizophrenia, bipolar, those kind of areas. So it's complicated. It's not, there's no simple answer to that. It does take a period of assessment and review and appointments with it. I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't go into vast detail and information in terms of how that works. I can only talk about my experience of being clinically diagnosed and being in psychiatry care. For my bipolar, it took about 6 months for me to receive that official psychiatric diagnosis. But it's very complicated because it can't be, there's no blood test. there's no brain scan kind of stuff. It's all behavioral led. So there's periods of assessment and talking about behaviors. Over the past 2 weeks, have you felt this? Have you felt that? Have you done this kind of stuff? And then they'll look at that. And then there's very obvious signs with some of the disorders, such as, you know, hallucinations.
Well, yeah, I mean, you say there's behavioral stuff there, and obviously there is, and lots of the treatments are around that behavioral cycle. I guess at some point you also start having, like, it's not a kind of like, you know, it's all in your mind kind of thing. Like, you're also starting having physical symptoms. I mean, a panic attack is a physical symptom, right? I mean, I speak as someone who's had them in the past. I have my own issues with anxiety in the past and still ongoing, because as you say, these things, you know, it's something you have to live with. And having a panic attack, yeah, I mean, it's all happening in your mind and stuff. It's very real to you, and it's very real to your body what's happening at that time, right? It's not like you're imagining it.
No, absolutely, 100% it's real. This is why it's important not to ignore anything that you might be experiencing or feeling kind of stuff. One of the things I say to kind of help with that, and it's also important to realize, and I think this is the point I'm trying to get across as well, is just because you might be experiencing those feelings of negative stress or distress, so you might feel like you're in mental decline, does not necessarily mean that you're mentally ill. And even if it were to the point that you were diagnosed with a condition or a disorder, then you can recover. You can recover from that. So it's very, very important to put that out there, because we don't want to be feeding further fear, which again feeds the stigma and stops people reaching out and getting the help that they need. So that's very important. I think that the most important thing is to recognize anything that you might be experiencing in this. Don't ignore it, in the same way that you would with physical aspects of your health. You know, if for a 2 week period you're getting a headache every day, you wouldn't ignore that. You would want to have a conversation with your doctor to say, I've been getting these headaches. I don't normally get this many headaches, but I'm getting a lot of headaches. That, because things like that can be a sign of poor mental health. And mental health does not sit in silo to physical health. The two are interlinked. So a lot of aspects of mental decline and poor mental health actually have physiological aspects in the body as well. Okay, when we're stressed or in mental decline, it can affect our heart. There's a massive link between poor mental health and heart health. There's a possibility, and the research, a lot more research is being done now in terms of links between mental health and other aspects of health. But they already know that a lot of heart disease and heart problems can be linked to poor mental health and prolonged periods of stress. And then there's gut health as well. Big links between mental health and gut health. I already mentioned the serotonin link, Crohn's, IBS, poor mental health. I have always, although I was actually a premature baby as well, and was born with gut problems as well. So, you know, lots of research is being done between people. Could that have fed my poor mental health? Because I actually nearly died as a prem baby because my gut wasn't formed properly. It's the two are interlinked. The important thing to remember is that there is no health without mental health or physical health. I would like us at some point in the future, when we stop isolating the two, we stop talking about mental health and physical health, we just talk about our health. And this is all part of that normalization journey that we need to be on.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I was just listening to a podcast just yesterday on some of the research coming out about the importance of gut health to pretty much everything. I mean, it's just fascinating how what's happening in your gut links to everything around your body. And of course, people know, even for stress management, one of the important things people say, and we'll get into actually in a sec about some of the ways of managing that, the importance of diet and all of that stuff. So that's not news to people. It's something, again, that's harder to stick to when you have all those challenges happening around your project management work. But it's everyone knows that diet is quite important.
Just to add to that panel, sorry, it's research here and look into probiotics. And this is no word of a lie. I now, well, for the last four or five months, I've actually been taking a daily probiotic supplement. And I have noticed a sizable improvement in terms of my stress levels and being able to manage. Most important, I manage my bipolar off medication. So just to prove that even if you live with a condition, you can manage that effectively without being souped up on drugs, as they call it. You can manage it effectively by looking at the foods you eat, self-care, sleep, all of those kind of self, really, really important self-care elements. But yeah, have a look into it. We'll have a look into probiotics. It's probably one of the most important food supplements that you can take daily.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into some of those coping strategies. I think we've been realistic and these things had to be said, but you know, like we painted a little bit of a dim picture. Let's look at basically what people can actually do about stress, because the one thing as event organizers, it's very hard to do for us, particularly, I should say, whether it's not particularly obvious to you, that in endurance events specifically, race directors, they have, I'm sure wedding planners do as well, but I know that side of things a little bit more. They're very often, you know, they have tons on their plate. They're like the one person on top of a very, 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 very short pyramid, mostly a pyramid of one in some cases, and they take on a lot. So stepping away is definitely not an option. Aside from that, let's talk about a few things that might be. And one of the things that struck me when we were discussing sort of about this offline is the importance of perfectionism and the importance of basically stepping out of the trap of perfectionism, which I can definitely see many event planners and organizers. And you said to me there something quite interesting, which is you want to be striding for excellence, not perfection.
Yeah. I have a 6-year-old little girl, and it's quite funny you talk about this. I have my daughter's 6. My world, my absolute world. And she turned around to me last night and she said, "Mummy, do you know what perfect is?" And I went, no, you tell me what perfect was. And I saw my husband's face, because he knows my view on perfection and stuff all the time. You could see him kind of, he always had this like half smile kind of stuff to kind of go, "Ooh, what's mummy going to say to this question?" And then "You tell me, darling, you tell me what perfection is." And she said, "It means when something is very, 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 very," and this went on for a while, "very, very good." I nodded at her. And again, I could see my husband out the corner of the eye. I could see him laughing kind of stuff, but not laughing, you know, that quiet laugh kind of stuff do when you know that someone's not looking at you. And I turned around and said, "There is no such thing as perfection, my darling. Okay, it doesn't exist. It's a word that we shouldn't use. The only thing that exists is something that is very, 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 very good or excellent. That's the only thing that exists and stuff." And that was the best thing, the best way. And she just nodded and went, "All right, mummy. Yeah." And she didn't ask it again. And I think that's a very real, we've been taught and conditioned, haven't we, to aim for perfection there. The perfect life, the perfect relationship, the perfect house, the perfect car, the perfect diet, the perfect wardrobe, the perfect this, the perfect that. That's what we've been conditioned from since we were children. You know, my daughter's coming home from school and saying that kind of stuff. It was like, no. There is no such thing as perfection. There might be in your eyes, in the eye of the beholder, is the only way that it can possibly exist. So there is an opportunity. There is a chance that, you know, you can sit down and you can have a meal, and that's a perfect meal that you could have eaten at that moment in time. So that's the thing with perfection. If it ever does exist, it is only a moment in time thing. And it's so subjective that it's not something that we should aspire to be trying to achieve. Because if we're aspiring to try and achieve perfection, we are setting ourselves up for a fall. We're setting ourselves up for, not that there's anything wrong with making mistakes, but we're just setting ourselves up for disappointment, because you're not going to achieve it. And especially not in the event world, because we're in the people industry. We are dealing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who all have their own idea of what perfection is. So if you aspire for your event, and what you were saying, it doesn't matter whether you're a wedding coordinator or wedding manager, or whether you're a race director, whether you're an event director, whether you're an exhibitions director, an operations director, you're all that person at the top of a tree with people underneath you. So if the person at the top of the tree is aspiring for perfection, think about all those people underneath that you're putting a whole different level of pressure onto their shoulders, because those people are not aspiring to their idea of perfection. They're aspiring to your idea of perfection, and they might not even know what that is.
Oh, I'm sure they won't, yeah.
I always have a very real mindset whenever I go into an event or whether I've got my event that I'm organising. And it's always the aspect that something will always go wrong. Something's going to go wrong. Doesn't matter how much I plan. Doesn't matter how many contingency plans that I try and put in place. And this is what will set you apart as that event director, operations director, wedding manager, race director, whatever that might be, is that mindset in terms of strive for excellence. Something's going to go wrong, but we're ready for it. So if you say this event's got to be perfect, you're not in that mindset. You're in a very fixed mindset, blinkered kind of state. So when something does go wrong, you're probably going to fall apart and be like, how do I deal with this? Where if you go for the excellence mindset, you're primed, you're ready. You're going to go, right, okay, something's going to go wrong. Someone's going to go off piste. Someone's going to do something they weren't supposed to be doing. Even though I told them 5 or 6 times not to do that, they're probably still going to do it. How are we going to respond to that? Okay, you ready for it? Perfection, closed, fixed mindset. You're not ready for anything to go wrong. Excellence, open mindset. You're ready and primed for something to go wrong. And that's what sets you apart as an event organizer working in our industry. Your response to something that happens. Okay, not how good your function sheet was and your event order and how good your planning still needs to be there. But that's not what sets you apart.
I guess another spin on this is to also basically sort of make yourself comfortable with imperfection, that you can sleep at night with things not being perfect, whatever that means, right? I mean, you need to be able to do that. Otherwise, it's just gonna drive you completely bonkers.
Yeah, exactly. I just see the whole perfect thing is it drives. It's all bonkers in every area of our life kind of stuff, you know? So it's take the pressure off your shoulders and take it out your backpack. What you're carrying that pressure around with you for is it's completely unnecessary kind of stuff. You know, it's just beggars. My mum always said to me growing up, all anybody can ever ask of you is that you do your best. So I was very lucky to have a realist as a mother. You kind of inspired that in me all anybody can ever ask is that you've done your best. And so long as you know that you've done your best, that ultimately will kind of feed that confidence for you to be able to go into any situation kind of stuff and deal with it effectively. And so, and those are things that have stayed. I don't know. Is it the reason I'm still here after 25 years? Probably, if honest. I think if I'd have been a strive for perfection, which I was a little bit in the beginning, I found it very hard to find my balance and my equilibrium in the beginning, as most people who are new to our industry do. But, you know, learn to get comfortable with excellence. Scrap perfection. It's holding you back. It is dragging you down and it's holding you back in terms of your capabilities and what you can achieve.
Yeah. And you mentioned there also, which I think is a big factor in all this, not so much to have planned out every single possible, you know, eventuality, but having good processes, I guess, and the right mindset to be able to respond to things.
Yeah. I mean, I'm neurodivergent, and yes, I've only just recently been diagnosed with that. And you'll actually find that there's a lot more neurodivergent people in our industry than we probably realise, to be honest with you. My presentation is actually, I'm ADHD and autism presentation. I'm a bit of both. So there can be times with a touring conflict. So actually the autistic side of me, that high functioning autism side of me, likes to plan. I like to have a job sheet. I like to have an event order. I like to plan done calls. I like to know, but the ADHD kind of side to me likes a bit of spontaneity kind of stuff. It has that cheeky kind of side to me. And I've always said this is throw me a challenge and watch me get to work type stuff. That's when I'm in my element kind of stuff. And it's like, woof, kind of stuff. And I carry that in all kind of areas of life. Kind of stuff. I remember quite famously doing a, a celebrity wedding. And in the morning of the wedding, and this hadn't been planned, the morning of the wedding, the bride calling up to say, yeah, so my auntie did has done my cake for me. We talked about 3 tiers, but she's actually done 5. So anybody that knows, and they weren't pillared because it's a homemade cake. You can't really pillar a homemade cake because it's not, there's a certain way of doing it. And to find that you try and pillar and tear up a homemade cake, it'll start to collapse after about an hour because it's not a professionally made cake. So you have to put it on stands. And it's very difficult for you to find a 5-tier stands. They generally don't exist. And this was about, she'd called me about 7 in the morning because obviously she's a bride. She won't have slept all night and it's a celebrity wedding. OK Magazine and the press and media are all there as well. And I was driving around Liverpool at 7:30 in the morning, finding a 5-tier cake. And that's the stuff that, and I found one. I found one. And I wasn't going to give up until I'd found the 5-tier cake. So use that cake analogy kind of stuff. Be the event organizer that loves the challenge of finding the 5-tier cake when you get that call at 7 in the morning. That's what you want to, not the event manager who's like, well, it's not, I can't do that for you, no, because it's not my order, which should be my autistic side. So sometimes that conflict between the two of those kind of works really well for me and my kind of mindset as an event organizer. So, you know, and that's the flexible mindset. Kind of stuff. Let's do this. We can do this.
Yeah, I know plenty of race directors who've had their 5-tier cake moments, the equivalent, I guess, of last minute curveballs. They're all over. You have to be able to manage that.
But remember as well that if you turn it, it's the buzz that, and we all know that dopamine hit that we get, and that's the reason why so many love our industry is actually the 5-tier cake moments. Not that everything went to plan on the order. Wasn't that exciting?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of us in our industry that love the 5-tier cake moments because then you're like, it's a fist pump kind of dopamine hit. So you might get a bit of serotonin. It might make you feel happy and nice because you've done, everything's gone to plan. Or the one time out of the 15 events you've done this year has gone to plan. But it's that dopamine hit of, look what we did. High five. Awesome. We rocked it.
Yeah, but I guess the important thing there, which we've been discussing, is that when your 5-tier cake moment comes, how well you're going to cope with that must depend on how much stress you have accumulated up to that point, right? Which comes back to the importance of, throughout this very long process of putting on an event, you need to have the moments where you truly let some steam off in some way, because when that emergency comes, it could be that drop that just completely breaks you apart, or it could be something you just take in your stride if you've managed your stress levels up to that point.
Yeah. And this is where the analogy of the stress bucket that I mentioned earlier comes in. So mental health world, so anybody who talks professionally on this subject or works professionally in the subject, so Mental Health First England use this, mine use this, we use it. So it's your stress bucket. And the idea of the stress bucket is that there's only so much you can fit in your bucket. You only have so much space in there. And your stress bucket, and remember what we were saying about the 5 elements of well-being. So actually, your stress bucket at work, well-being at work isn't always about work. It's what's in your stress bucket at any one time. So it's what's going on at home. How well are those relationships at home? Have you got anybody, with a lot of us, they've got elderly parents that caring for, you know, we've got an aging population. There's a lot of young people actually dealing with that at the minute. Okay. So throw that in there. Kids, throw that in there. Anything that you are thinking about, worrying about, stressed about, those little thoughts that you get in your head each day, chuck that in your stress bucket. And then it's being able to look at that bucket and kind of go, how full is it? How much space have I got left at the top? And that is your resilience. Okay. That's your resilience to be able to respond to the 5-tier cake moment, okay? If your stress bucket is full, you're not going to be able to respond to the 5-tier cake moment very well. So, and this is where the self-awareness comes in. So self-awareness is not just listening to your body and what's going on, but also being able to go, right, okay, what have I got on this week? What is a priority this week? What do I need to do? What can wait? What can I delegate? What can I give to somebody else? Okay. That's why perfectionism, you know, scrapping perfectionism is really important, because perfectionism stops us delegating as well. Because we always think, oh, I can do it better myself because this has got to be perfect. Okay. So excellence, you're more likely to delegate stuff to other people because your stress bucket is full. And then what you've got to imagine on the side of your stress bucket is a little tap. And your self-care releases the pressure from the bucket. So it doesn't matter how much is in the bucket. If you've got your bucket is full, you need to up the ante on the self-care, which means that if you've got a lot of things going on, you need to rest more. You need to do more things. And this will be different for everybody else. We all release stress in different ways, whether that's taking a bath, whether that's reading a book, whether that's going and doing a 10K or a half K at the marathon at the weekend, whether it's seeing friends, whether it's spending time with your kids, whether it's just resting and doing nothing, whether it's been watching Home of Dragon, whatever that might be for you, you need to work out, what are my things? Playing music, listening to music, dancing. What are my self-care elements? What am I, what's going to release some of that pressure? What's going to make me feel good to release some of that pressure out the bucket? And it's important that we do it. And the more full your bucket is, the more self-care you need to have. But unfortunately, what we tend to do is the fuller the bucket gets, the less self-care we do, because we equate it to time. Don't have time. Don't have time. Don't have time for that. You do. You're just choosing not to make time for it. You're prioritizing other things. So we've got to stop seeing it as a measure of time. Self-care is a measure of time. We've got to see self-care as a prioritization, as a measure of prioritizing better, okay? And starting to make more net positive decisions for our well-being as opposed to net negative decisions. So having a lot in, lot on, and deciding to work until 1-2 in the morning to get that stuff done, rather than actually thinking, well, maybe actually I should have an early night so I'm rested, so I'll be more productive to finish that off in the morning. That's the difference between a net negative decision, which is working till 1-2 in the morning, as opposed to a net positive decision, which is go to bed at 10 o'clock, get a good night's sleep, recharge your brain and your batteries, be more productive to work on. Because you'll get yourself into a decline itself of burning. Remember that resistance kind of stage of stress? You need to up in resistance, you need to up the self-care. Resistance stage, you're going to find if you're not dealing with it, your stress bucket is going to get higher and higher and more full and more full and more full. And that's when you end up in the exhaustion, burnout stage of stress, because you haven't dealt with your stress effectively in the resistance stage. And that resistance stage is that complete planning stage of an event. Okay. And that can be the difference between you being on it and having the energy and the fuel to be able to perform and deliver that event to the best of your ability. Or actually, once that event has ended, you are that exhausted because you're already in exhausting stage that you're emotionally unstable. You go into complete mental decline. You actually become unwell, and not just with mental decline, but also physical illness. So if you're somebody that tends to get ill after you've worked, you need to look at that resistant stage management a bit better.
Did you know that in a recent survey, 73% of responders said that reading reviews influences which races they enter? Well, RaceCheck is the largest aggregator of race reviews in the world and has collected over 40,000 reviews for over 6,000 events globally. So, how can you collect more reviews for your event and make the most of them to increase your race registrations? Well, you can start by listening to our Power of Race Reviews podcast from September 20th last year. Plenty of tips there on growing your race reviews. And then visit organizers.racecheck.com. That's organizers with an S, .racecheck.com, to download your free RaceCheck review box so you can start showing all your race reviews on your website for an instant boost to your race's social proof and conversions. It really is a no-brainer. So go to organizers.racecheck.com. That's organizers with an S, .racecheck.com, and download your free RaceCheck review box today. Okay, let's get back to the episode. Throughout this process, we've talked about diet and other kind of, you know, good habits you can pick up. You mentioned sleep there. It's another area much less mystified by now. We know quite a lot about sleep. It's something that also people struggle with because it's another catch-22. The more you have to do, as you say, you cut down on your sleep, or maybe you don't sleep very well. You know, you get up at the middle of the night, start worrying about things, particularly with endurance events when there's, you know, like people's well-being on the line. How important is that basically in de-stressing during that phase?
Yeah, so there are three elements of well-being, which are the exercise and movement, diet, nutrition, and sleep. I would say that sleep is the bedrock for those three. So you've got sleep at the bottom, and then your diet and nutrition, your exercise sit on top of those. So your sleep is the ultimate foundation. It's been heavily underrated for such a long time. And then also as well, in terms of our culture, since the 80s, really, I would say, we've pushed the work hard, play hard mentality, haven't we? And sleep has been the one that has suffered as a result of that. And that's because we haven't really understood the impact that lack of sleep can have on our body, and understood kind of what's actually happening within the brain and the body when we sleep. It's a complete restoration and recovery stage, sleep. It's also where we kind of process data in our working memory into a long-term memory while we sleep as well. And if you don't get a good night's sleep, and that happens during REM sleep. So REM sleep doesn't happen, or you don't have good REM sleep, you'll forget things more easily, kind of stuff. So if you've actually had a busy, productive day, and this is especially important for event coordinators, because you need to be on it in terms of conversations, agreements, what's been put in place, what's been coordinated, what's everyone doing. So sleep fundamentally, and particularly your REM sleep, is really, really important for us. So watching what we drink, in terms of REM sleep, we all have had those nights, haven't we? I haven't drank in 10 years because I stopped drinking, not for my mental health, but the reason I decided to keep up, it was actually because I was planning my little girl. But the reason I've abstained is for my mental health and well-being. It's a lifestyle choice now. We drink too much. We've all had those nights where you woke up the morning after and be like, can't remember what happened. What happened? Can you remember? What did we do? I didn't. Did I? No. Oh, no. Okay, we've all had those moments at some point. So the ones that will hold their hands up and admit, that's because of REM sleep. Now, what alcohol does is it hampers REM sleep. And REM processes your working memory data bank into your long-term memory data bank. It's a very simple transition. That's why we dream, okay? So it's your brain. It's the internal process of your brain kind of processing things that stimuli and information data that we've picked up. So it's a really, really important process for sleep. So we have to remember that. So you've got exams coming up. You've got any kind of, you've got a big meeting coming up that you're preparing for. Think about your REM sleep. It really helps you. And then there's also the recovery and the restoration and repair kind of elements of sleep as well. So we do actually think that there's big links now between lack of sleep and dementia later in life, particularly in terms of Alzheimer's, because actually what happens when we're sleeping as well, plaques are cleared away in the brain. It's like you're giving your brain a really lovely bubble bath, and you need to be having good 7 to 9 hours sleep for that plaque clearance to happen, be restored. If you're depriving yourself of sleep, that plaque clearance isn't going to work, and then those plaques build up, and Alzheimer's is linked to plaque buildup in the brain. Okay. Neurons are repaired. You've got the growth hormone in the body that only repairs itself during sleep. Okay. And that isn't necessarily making us all look younger and taking away wrinkles, but we're talking about cell renewal in the body as well. So that happens when we sleep. It is the most important element of self-care. You can survive for longer without food than you can without sleep. You keep somebody awake for longer and you watch what starts to happen to that person. There's plenty. If you Google some videos on YouTube, they did actually do some scientific studies on some young people to see what happened. And you started to see elements of psychosis and hallucinations start to come in, because you do start to go. We've all felt it when we've pulled an all-nighter, for example, how we felt it. You just feel weird kind of stuff. So you can actually survive longer without food than you can without sleep. And then, and as well, in terms of sleep, it's 7 to 9 hours don't try and make up at the weekend. So having 9+ hours at the weekend, it's not good for you. It's trying to have a consistent, nice, healthy circadian rhythm in terms of your sleep. There are times, and there are going to be times in our industry that this happens. If you can only get 5 hours sleep because it's the night before an event, or you're in event mode, and as well, remember that stress response. Cortisol in the stress response actually hampers with melatonin release that we need to help us sleep. So you're going to find around about event time, it's going to be really hard for you to be able to drop off to sleep as easier as before. So one tip is don't get into your bed until you feel tired. You need your brain to associate your bed with sleep and the other functionality that you do in bed sometimes. So there's two things. So don't get into bed if you're not feeling, and this actually comes from Matthew Walker. Look up Matthew Walker's stuff is the biggest tip I can give you. Just Google Matthew Walker and listen to some of his TED Talks. Watch his stuff on YouTube. He's amazing. You'll learn everything that you need to know from this man, Professor Matthew Walker. Okay. Don't get into bed unless you're tired. If it's taking you longer than 20 minutes to drop off, get back up, go and do something. Wait until you start to feel tired, get back into bed. And if you can only have 5 hours sleep, make sure it's the best 5 hours sleep that you can have. So make sure that give yourself the best chance to get that REM, repair and restoration. So that's blackout blinds, 17 to 19 degrees in terms of room temperature, comfy sheets, really go as all out as you possibly can in terms of making your bed a haven to sleep. Okay. No devices, no blue lights. If you need an alarm clock, buy an alarm clock. You can still buy alarm clocks, I think, and stuff. We have an Alexa alarm clock. So if you want a modern device, you can buy an Alexa. So sleep, and we've mentioned diet and nutrition and exercise. Now it's not, we all know we're all grown ups. We all know that we should be eating healthily and exercising. We've had it drummed into us for a very long time. So we all know. But for us and for me and for Team Eventwell, it's very much about the mention before, those net positive and those net negative decisions. So, you know, can you have the side salad rather than the bowl of chips? Think about making more net positive decisions and reducing your net negative decisions. Okay. Exercise is just, you don't need to be doing endurance events. Okay. You might be an event director that actually loves organizing endurance events, but can't think of anything worse than actually taking part in one and thinks everybody that's actually taking part in that event is a complete nutcase. Sorry. But, you know, exercise, 30 minutes moderate exercise a day, which can be just walk an extra stop, walk to and from the office rather than getting the bus if it's like a 15-minute walk. So, you know, do we all know what we should be doing? But also as well, be realistic about that. It's not all about 100% net positive decisions, because that can actually be detrimental to your mental health as well. And I like to say, I'm going to bring a cake analogy back in here. So, you know, eat the cake. Sharing a cupcake with a friend over a glass of wine, which, you know, the cake and the glass of wine are both net negative decisions, but you're spending quality time with a friend, which is a net positive decision for your mental health. So make sure you put some realism in there. And it's about balance. Everything is about balance.
You don't want to start stressing about your distressing, right? I mean, you don't want to sort of like start being really anxious, you know, like they say this quite a lot in mindfulness as well. You don't want to just force yourself to be, you know, too aware of that stuff, right? Or be too strict with, am I going to have the cupcake or whatever? You know, like if you think you're going to feel better with a friend, have the cupcake, okay? One cupcake is not going to kill you. I want to wrap up on something that I think is also quite important. We've been discussing sleep, diet, exercise, planning, perfection, all of that stuff, which is sort of like great stuff. But for some people who may be further down the road of mental decline, or who just happen to be through even more enormous stress than that, these things may be insufficient. When it comes to sort of like, you know, you feel like you need to be doing more, you feel like you can't manage, what mechanisms are there to basically help you cope beyond that? Whom do you turn to when you actually start feeling quite helpless and stressed beyond the point that you can self-manage?
There's two facets to this. So very much what I was saying about that self-awareness. So get to know yourself better than you know everybody else. So we tend to say that we know our friends better than they know themselves. That therefore the same is true as ourselves. You know, there are probably people out there that are aware of our personality and our behaviours and the little quirks and stuff that we do more than we are. Yeah, we all have those friends, don't we? Where a friend says, "You aware that you do this when you're eating?" And stuff like that as well. And you kind of go, "No idea. Thanks for sharing that with me." But it's, you know, get to know yourself better. Really, really top up your self-awareness. So get used to, your body will send you little signals if you're aware of it in terms of what it needs. So you'll get little tweaks and pains and stuff. When you start to feel tension and stress, you start to kind of feel it in your shoulders and your neck and stuff. As you can feel a bit of tension in your headache. Don't ignore that. That's your body turning around saying, starting to feel tense and stuff, and not feeling comfortable. It's really about upping your self-awareness. But kind of bring it back to what I've just said about our friends and our partners and our loved ones kind of knowing us really well. Take it from experience of me, who's kind of managed and lived with bipolar disorder for 30 plus years, 33 years now this year. You can, as much as you can manage it, and you can live a very, very normal life living with a condition. Just because I have a mental health condition doesn't mean that I have poor mental health, by the way. Sometimes my mental health can be much better than somebody who doesn't live with a condition. In the same way, that works the same way for people living with physical health conditions as well, by the way. But I can't do it on my own. We're not supposed to be in isolation anyway. Our relationships are really important to us. So I talk to my friends and my family. I tell them the signs to look out for. I tell them that when I'm starting to feel stressed and agitated, this is what happens. Even my six-year-old little girl knows that sometimes if mummy snaps a little bit quicker than, or reacts a little bit quicker than she normally would, my little girl will know that mummy's overtired and mummy might be feeling a bit stressed, because I've explained to her and I've talked to her and very open about it. So be open about who you are, and if you're managing any kind of health condition, talk to your friends and family about it, because they can be that early indicator. They can spot something in you before you do. And can turn around and say, my husband knows if I'm stressed, or turn around and say, "Do you want an early night? I'll do this. You go and get some rest in an early night," kind of stuff. And that's his way of saying, you look a bit, and we all, and don't take it as an insult. Don't take it as these people care about you fundamentally. They're not doing it to cause you harm. Or we would hope that the vast majority of people that are doing that are not doing that to cause you harm. They're doing it because they care about you and they want to help. So speak, talk to your friends and family, tell them anything you might be experiencing. But also, not even, it's just if you're not managing the condition as well, it's important to talk. So have conversations, go and do your research, all the stuff that I've talked about today. Go away and make one of your things to do post listening to this podcast, is that you go away and you do your own research. There's plenty of resources out there. You can find resources on the EventWell website. We've got lots of fact sheets on there. There's the NHS website. There's Every Mind Matters website. There's Young Minds if you're under the age of 25. 75% of people that will develop a mental health condition will do so before the age of 25. And that's because our brains actually haven't stopped developing until we're in our late 20s. So we're more susceptible to developing mental health conditions. So ignore that, you know, all those comments that we used to get when we were 16. "You're a grown up now, you should know better." So you're not actually officially a grown up, probably from a brain development psychology perspective, until you're in your late 20s. So cut yourself a bit of slack. Go and read, make this one of your things to do over the next 6 months, that you become an expert in yourself and your own mental health and the stuff that you need. And then get your toolkit ready. So remember your stress bucket and relieving those pressures. What are your things? Okay. What are your things that will bring you from stress to calm, but bring you from fight, flight, freeze to rest and digest as quickly as possible? In terms of the resistance stage, look up breath work. So I am a fan of mindfulness. It doesn't work for everybody though. It doesn't necessarily work for me. It does sometimes. Remember, I'm also neurodivergent and ADHD, so I actually find it very difficult at times. So I have to be, I can use it as certain. If I'm feeling manic as a result of my bipolar, it helps, but other times I find it quite difficult. So actually what I use is breath work. And everybody should use breath work. So breath work isn't a mindfulness thing. Mindfulness just use the breath as a center. Anybody, you'll know panic, if you've experienced a panic attack, what's the first thing a paramedic or a first aider tells you to do? It's breathe. Because it's actually the only tool we have at our disposal for us to automatically trigger the parasympathetic nervous system by deep breathing. So if you do diaphragmatic, proper deep belly breathing, longer out breath than in breath, and you'll really trigger that parasympathetic nervous system. It's the only way of us self-triggering that system. So learn about breath work and get some real good breathing techniques and breathing tools in your toolkit as well. That's the biggest thing I can say. So keep an eye on your stress bucket. Really, really learn about, become an expert in yourself. Learn about your behaviors and triggers. And then breath work, breathing and self-care.
Yeah, we should have mentioned breathing actually. It is remarkably effective for what it is. I think one deep breath or like a couple of deep breaths at the right moment, they can have more of an effect than any calming medicine or whatever you can take. You see people that when they're stressed, they don't even breathe properly. They just, you know, like hold their breath. You don't know it. There's a thing called, I was reading like a couple of months ago, called email apnea, which is when you actually read your emails and you're so tense that you actually read your emails without breathing. And I noticed it on my wife once when she was sitting in the office. So it's, yeah, breath is super, super important. You also mentioned the resources you guys have on eventwell.org. You want to tell people a little bit more about what they can find on the site, how they can reach out to you personally if they feel like they may need some support or someone to speak to. Tell us a couple of things about that as we wrap up.
Absolutely. So you'll find us at eventwell.org. Very easy. There's a resources section. You'll find the resources section on the website, so in the menu bar. And under that resources section, you'll find five key areas, which are career well-being, social well-being, financial well-being, personal well-being, and community or environmental well-being is in there. You'll also find the Every Mind Matters tool. We partner with Public Health England. So the Better Health Every Mind Matters tool is on there, which is an NHS tool. Basically, what you do is you just put in five questions. You answer four or five questions in terms of what's going on for you right now, how you're feeling right now. And then it will give you personalized recommendations in terms of try this, do that. And you can factor them, you can play around with them, and it will send you email reminders and stuff as well. It's a fantastic tool. I use it quite regularly, so do kind of check that out. There's a mental wellbeing scale on there, so you can actually go in there, you can answer six questions. It will give you a score, and then you can use that score to determine about whether or not you should go and have a chat with your GP. We always say first and foremost, so take a look at that. And then there's other links in there, such as sustainable development goals are in there, and that link to mental health and wellbeing, which is one of the sustainable development goals under health, which is the third sustainable development goal. So, and then under those five key areas from career to community, there's fact sheets, there's videos, there's links to blogs and stuff as well. So go and check out some of those resources. And also as well, make sure that you're following us.
Well, Helen, thank you very much for taking the time to share some of this stuff with us. I think we went into a territory that's not strictly about putting on a great event, but I think it's so pivotal to everything we do in this industry and keeping everyone sane in a pretty tough environment, particularly after COVID and all the stuff we've had. So thank you very much for coming on to speak to us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much to everyone listening in, and we will see you all on our next podcast. I hope you enjoyed today's episode on managing stress with Eventwell founder and chief executive Helen Moon. You can find more resources on anything and everything related to race directing on our website, racedirectorshq.com. You can also share your thoughts about today's topic or anything else in our Facebook group, Race Directors Hub. Many thanks again to our awesome podcast sponsors, Run Sign Up and Race Check, for sponsoring today's episode. And if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe on your favorite player and check out our podcast back catalog for more great content like this. Until our next episode, Take care and keep putting on amazing races.